Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. This is the fourth day of The Realignment's daily coverage of the Ukraine crisis. Quick run of show. Wednesday, I had Nate Sibley on to talk about sanctions, the oligarchy, and what will and what won't change Putin's regime. Thursday, Sagar and I did a discussion Q&A episode. Finally, on Friday, I had Dr. David Kilcullen to talk about counterinsurgency and Ukraine's long-term prospects. A question that we've gotten a lot has been a degree of discomfort around MasterCard, Visa, Facebook, now TikTok, all these different companies joining the sanctions against Russia as part of the broader strategy of economic punishment for the invasion of Ukraine. A lot of people, while agreeing with the need to punish Russia to, quote Nate Sibley, limit their ability to wage war, they're still a little uncomfortable with companies taking these actions. They're not quite sure they can trust a company to be very fair and accurate. And other people, especially on the right, worry that, hey, is this an example of virtue signaling, cancel culture, deplatforming? Someone on the left would even then add too, oh, I'm worried that companies are entering into the foreign policy sphere. People could take different perspectives on those. But overall, I wanted to do an episode directly on this topic, so I decided to bring back a great guest of the show, Alec Ross. He came on the show last September to talk about his book, The Raging 2020s, Companies, Countries, People, and the Fight for Our Future. The basic idea of the book is that as we're looking at this decade, we should really think of the fact that you have companies operating in many ways that states do and often used to fill, this real mix of public and private intersection here. So this is really an episode where we're focused on unpacking that idea specifically in the case of Russia and how much this is left up to companies and how much this is actually government driving things. Few quick things to go before this episode starts. Another really great one. A, we're going to keep on publishing near exclusive Ukraine content the rest of the month. Send us an email or leave us a review. realignmentpod@gmail.com to ask for a specific topic or send your questions for Sagar and I discussed. Two, would love a tip. There is a link in the show notes. If you liked an episode, send a tip. Three, Substack comes out on Thursdays or Friday if things are chaotic, so you can subscribe in the show notes as well. Finally, huge shout out to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. And of course, be sure to check out our bookshop where you could purchase Alec and any other of our authors' books. Enjoy the episode. Alec Ross, welcome back to The Realignment.
Thank you for having me.
I have to start with it's not even a joke, but it's something I saw on Twitter and I thought of your book. Your book is called The Raging 2020s, Companies, Countries, People, and the Fight for Our Future. Someone tweeted, man, it really feels like we went from the roaring 20s right to the 1930s. Obviously, the raging 2020s was in reference to this roaring 2020s image we have. So with everything that's just happened in the 5-6 months since we spoke, I'd love for you just to talk about, like, top level, what this decade's feeling like for you.
Yeah, I mean, we are in a moment where it feels like the early 1930s. And, you know, for our non-history geek listeners, you know, that was a moment of a lot of economic dislocation where countries chose wildly different economic and political models. In the United States, we went from sort of pro-business, slightly laissez-faire republicanism to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. Italy embraced fascism and Mussolini. Germany embraced Nazism and Hitler. And so it was a moment of fairly profound transition. Nationalism, an attempt to sort of re-moor people to place and to nationality. And we're seeing a lot of those same 1,000-year-old dynamics play out right now. And so in the last 5 or 6 months, what we've just seen is an acceleration of the dynamic that I described in this book of mine, The Raging 2020s, where we're going from sort of the neat, usually neat architecture of the post-Cold War world to something entirely different.
Yeah, so before we get into the specific company part of your framework, because this is a very specialized episode. A lot of folks have written enough questions around companies sanctioning Russia. This is sort of a quasi nation state thing. Am I comfortable? Am I uncomfortable? Does it even matter? Is this even a question that a nation state should be able to determine? We'll get to that. But I want to just start with you're in the State Department. So just your personal history with Ukraine, and then just like your assessment of the situation. We're recording this on Friday the 4th, so I don't need a tactical analysis. We don't need you to tell us where the convoy is located, but just your broad picture.
Sure. So I do have some funky history in Ukraine. I mean, I had a great grandfather who was born in Kyiv, who actually fled to the United States. He emigrated to the United States because he was fleeing the Tsar's police. And he was fleeing the Tsar's police because he was an anarchist back when anarchy was an actual political movement as opposed to, you know, a calling to arms for teenagers. And then when I was at the State Department, I did a lot of work in Eastern Europe and in Ukraine specifically. And the funny thing about that is most of what I did there was pretty banal and benign. You know, a lot of it was about strengthening civil society and other such things. But the Putin government latched onto it. And when the Maidan protests began in 2014, you know, this is the period where, you know, to remind our viewers, the pro-Putin, pro-Russia government was essentially kicked out of Ukraine. I was actually banned from Ukraine because the pro-Putin forces thought that I was playing the role of digital organizer for what was taking place in Maidan, which frankly, I wish I had that much power, but I don't. And so there is this weird, I have this weird history there. And part of what I've seen is it's alternately brutal and ridiculous. You know, there is a lot of death, there's a lot of conflict, but there's also a slightly ridiculous aspect to it where you feel like you're in a Leslie Nielsen movie, where, you know, the tradecraft, the statecraft, and some of the tactics are just straight out of something like the 1970s. I mean, we saw this, you know, very recently, even with the attacks against the nuclear facility in Ukraine, which it appears now that they may not have even known they were attacking a nuclear facility. Some did, some didn't know, but this was something of enormous global significance. But there was, you know, it may very well be the case that there was as much incompetence as strategy behind this. My very quick read of what's taking place there right now is if I were to frame this in a way of that's, you know, making a binary between, you know, hey, the safety and well-being of Ukraine is good and getting the Russians the hell out is good, and therefore the Russian incursion is bad, I would say that we can draw some good things and some bad things at the moment. The good things is that the Ukrainians are proving to be a hell of a lot tougher than anybody expected. I think Putin clearly thought that this was going to be like the United States rolling into Kuwait. It's not. One of the things that Putin forgot was that Ukrainians were actually the most ferocious soldiers during World War II. And the Ukrainians are doing a great job holding their ground. They're holding their ground with some support from the West, but this is really a Ukrainian effort. The negative side is that we haven't really even begun to see the worst of what the Russians have in terms of capabilities. And what I imagine is if you look at Putin's history in Chechnya, in Aleppo, he has a history where when they fail to make progress on the ground, they will just bombard the hell out of a given place, leave it in rubble, and then march in. And we have to remember, for all that is inspiring us about Ukraine and the Ukrainians right now, the Russians are still capable of that. There is a massive asymmetry right now in terms of military capabilities. So even looking into the next few days, with public sentiment, with even the Ukrainians doing a remarkable job holding ground there, what I expect is a fairly brutal period in the next few days where Russia, where Putin specifically asserts the benefits of asymmetry, of military asymmetry.
Follow up here would basically be when you use, and it's depressing that I've been plugged into this online discourse, when you use words like Ukrainian civil society, those are seen as euphemisms for, and this is how Putin sees it, euphemisms for US meddling, control, all these different dynamics. What's interesting though is that to your story and to the broader perspective, it seems as if Ukraine, in terms of its statehood, its national identity, its military. Things have gotten better since 2014, 2015. So can you just, from your experience, like being before you were banned, obviously, how would you just chart the course of Ukrainian civil society, like in the non-euphemistic sense?
Sure. So Ukraine, first of all, it was always a center of scientific and technical and technological excellence, you know, through the Soviet era. You know, and even before, it's where Sikorsky helicopters were invented. It was where a lot of the great scientists and technologists of the Soviet era came from. And after the fall of the Soviet Union, Ukraine was a mess. And in many respects, just like Mother Russia to the north, it was oligarched. You know, a series of oligarchs took political and economic command of the country. Unlike some of the countries in the Caucasus, and frankly, unlike Russia itself, though, it had a lot more intellectual capital on a per capita basis. Like it had these great scientific and technological assets, but it squandered them for the most part. So if you think about WhatsApp, for example, WhatsApp was founded by a Ukrainian, Jan Koum, born and raised in Ukraine, but he had to come to the United States to commercialize it. So it's interesting in that it was a place of remarkable potential that began to make progress, but a lot of that progress was stilted by the deeply corrupt oligarchical nature of the country. Then eventually the sort of pro-Russian oligarchs overplayed their hand. So Yanukovych, who was from a pro-Russian party called the Party of Regions, effectively stole an election, and through the great work of civil society, specifically journalists, they uncovered, you know, $1 billion+ of resources that Yanukovych had looted. He was then forced out of government. The person who then succeeded him was another oligarch, a guy named Petro Poroshenko, who I actually fairly good. Friends might be too strong a word, but you know, he's an oligarch. He's worth hundreds of millions of dollars, but he was not as malignant as some of the others. And then there was this really interesting transition where he was defeated by Zelensky, who we're all now getting to know, who in many respects is the first truly non-corrupt, non-oligarch leader of Ukraine. And so these past few years have seen some fairly remarkable progress in Ukraine, which is part of why I think Putin engaged here in the first place. He did not like the idea of an independent, strengthening Ukraine immediately to his south with this charismatic, Western-oriented Jewish comedian head of state that was not the oligarch or the pro-Russian vassal that he was used to. So there was a lot of progress in Ukraine, which was one of the factors that led us to this present moment.
So I'm going to do the ultimate faux pas. I did not grab my charger. So I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to step off the mic and you're going to just continue talking. So, okay. So now we've got your background, which I failed to do proper research and I did not know all this. So a total sidetrack to the actual topic. A lot of people are talking about the actual company, corporate, private sector, even response to Putin's invasion. I love for you, we were emailing a bit. I'd love for you to describe from your perspective, like what that response is and how it fits into your book's framework of companies, countries, and people.
Sure. So first of all, some big picture framing first. Look, the world in 2022, we are in many respects more governed by companies than we are by countries. And the world's biggest and most powerful companies are as powerful as nation states. You know, Alphabet is a country. Amazon is a country. Exxon is a country. Facebook is a country. And they have, frankly, the wealth and capabilities that we historically would associate with a nation state. This is something that is new relative to what was the case, you know, before the fall of the Soviet Union and the acceleration of globalization. What I would say in this present context, what is the role of the private sector right now in this conflict? It's substantial. They are protagonists. So at the beginning of this conversation, you and I were talking about all things military. But truthfully, at the end of the day, I don't think Putin is going to be defeated militarily. He almost can't be defeated militarily because they're a nuclear power. At the end of the day, the only way that he can be defeated is politically by his own people within his own country and or economically. And what we've already seen are the absolutely ferocious effects of sanctions and of the private sector, independent of sanctions, taking actions to withdraw or otherwise cut off Russia from the rest of the world. And so what I would say at this point is it's important to understand that some of what the private sector is doing, they have to do. So, you know, a lot of what we see American businesses receding from Russia, and they're doing big announcements announcing they're doing this. It's lovely that they're making these announcements, but they're compelled to do so by law. When we put a lot of these sanctions in place, what we're doing is we're making certain kind of commercial activity with Russia illegal. Okay. So it's all good and well that the private sector is receding in many respects and getting good PR for it, but a lot of it was compelled by the sanctions regime put in place by the EU and put in place by the United States. In addition to this, though, what we are seeing are things that I wouldn't have predicted. I don't think anybody would have predicted in terms of an economic decoupling that goes far beyond the range of the sanctions. Between Russia and the West. So if you think, you know, look, we're used to sort of the technology community being, you know, call them more progressive, call them more woke, call them whatever the hell you want. But we don't necessarily think of that in terms of the oil companies. But what we've seen is a decoupling of Exxon from a multi-billion dollar partnership in Russia. We've seen British Petroleum, basically lop off 10% of its enterprise value by virtue of a decoupling from Russia. So what we're really seeing is something that can't be reversed. If, for example, tomorrow Putin woke up and said, you know what, this wasn't worth it. Let's go back to how things were. What's fascinating right now is to see the degree to which the really big American and European companies are cutting off oxygen to the Russian economy. And the only slight laggard in this, interestingly, are some of the big financial companies like BlackRock. Just unwinding some of the incredibly complex securities, some of the ETFs and other things that they've done, everybody's going to lose a lot of money as they do this. Some are moving faster than others. Some have higher degrees of complexity than others. But, you know, honestly, if we see the BlackRocks and the JP Morgans and some of those really unwind out of Russia, then we're going to see, you know, a country without capital and a country without access to outside capital. It's going to be, they are effectively about to become North Korea.
Okay. There's so many interesting things there. Let me just pick them up in no particular order. Now, I support everything that you just described. However, a critical piece of audience feedback that I got, and I think this is a good argument, is a lot of folks who want this to de-escalate think you need to give Putin an off-ramp. And it seems as if you say this decoupling, this strangulation of their economy is effectively not something that can be reversed, it seems like we've taken this is the point of your framework. We isn't even the right word here, but it seems like an off-ramp has been lost without a societal debate, how do you think about that part?
So first of all, it's really legitimate feedback because if what we do is we blow up every bridge between the West and Russia, then there's no bridge for them to cross, right? I mean, they are well and truly isolated. And to the extent that Russian citizens themselves feel the pain of this isolation, you know, if they stand in line for 2.5 hours at an ATM and they don't get anything, like this stuff hits home real quick. If they wake up in the morning and their rubles are worth 40% less than they were before, they feel the force and effect of that. So that is I'll be honest with you, it's a completely valid concern. And I do hope for all of the sort of chest beating excitement that there is about, you know, the brave Ukrainians holding their ground and all the cheerleading we're doing for Zelensky, all of which we should do, really responsible statesmanship right now requires our identifying off-ramps and ways to de-escalate the conflict. Now, the thesis right now is that the best way to actually exert any sort of leverage over Putin is economically. Look, if we're not going to go soldier to soldier with him, if we're not going to take a 19-year-old from Alabama and put him on a battlefield with a 19-year-old from St. Petersburg, which I think we've decided not to do, then what we're left with that's really sharp are economic sanctions, our economic means. So that was a deliberate and strategic choice. And what's interesting was how quickly this sort of gained steam. You know, at the beginning, people were not talking about cutting Russia off from SWIFT. We were talking about sanctions exemptions. You know, I spent a lot of time in Italy, and it was funny to me to listen to Mario Draghi at the beginning try to get sanctions exemptions for the export of luxury goods, you know, so the Russians could continue to buy their Gucci loafers. But then, you know, in sort of the heat of the moment, there was a remarkable acceleration of what the West was willing to do economically. And what I imagined would have taken place over a month or 6 weeks took place in like 6 days. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, but what I am saying is that we have to have eyes open to consequences. There is a very well-known commentator, a regional expert named Anders Osland. And he tweeted something recently where he said, you know, we can't be talking about off-ramps for Putin. We should only be talking about the International Criminal Court. We should be talking about The Hague. And even though a lot of us may feel that emotionally or believe that intellectually, that as a policy matter, that as public rhetoric is what backs the world's second most powerful military into a corner. And so responsible statesmanship does not tell Putin you're either going to The Hague or, you know, our objective for you is The Hague. Like, if we tell him that, then he is capable of launching a nuclear missile. Then he is capable of holding out for a year or more. So that at the core of your listeners' concerns and of your question is something that is totally and completely intellectually valid and important, even if it cuts across the grain of the emotional sentiment of the moment. And frankly, of what we all may ultimately want for Putin. I want Putin dead and buried, but all of our wanting him dead and buried does not necessarily get us any closer to a resolution.
I'm fascinated by your use of the word statesmanship in this context, because once again, if in many ways companies are acting as countries, if it's Facebook, because of dual class share structures, Mark Zuckerberg actually is effectively the king. But a lot of companies, you know, Microsoft, for example, you know, I don't think Satya Nadella has as much control over the company as Zuckerberg does, but Microsoft just pulled out of Russia. They pulled Office product, Microsoft Office products, insert whatever joke you want to make there. But so at a broader level, there's also the stock market and the stock price and all these different bits. So if you're thinking of just like this idea of companies as countries, how do different forms of company ownership and management and stock-based incentives play into the framework you're making, given the decisions they're faced with right now?
So I think that's an important question. So some of these companies are totalitarian, and some of them are more democratic and have a broader set of relevant stakeholders. So if we're talking about Facebook or Meta, as the king wants to call it now, you know, Meta is a totalitarian state. And, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, by virtue of the power of his shareholding, what he decides, whether that is, you know, with what's allowed in terms of election advertising on his platform, what's allowed in terms of messaging over WhatsApp, what's allowed in terms of who can publish on Facebook. I mean, he is effectively a king there. And the problem with Mark, you know, who I do know, and he and I we've mostly gotten along in the past, though our most recent conversation was unpleasant. The problem with Mark and some of his peers is that they're very smart. They have high IQs. They're intelligent, but they aren't wise. They are not geopolitically astute. They don't understand cultures that are different than their own. A lot of them became very rich and very powerful at very young ages. And so they never traveled the world as a quote unquote normal person. They never experienced it except after landing in a private jet with a phalanx of, you know, lots of handlers around them. So companies like Facebook are really powerful, which makes a person like Mark Zuckerberg really powerful. And I have absolutely no trust in him whatsoever. By contrast, there are other companies. Let's take my, you mentioned Microsoft, for example. Microsoft is not totalitarian. They have a technocratic CEO in Satya Nadella. Their president and general counsel is a guy named Brad Smith, who's actually, you know, the more political, he sort of drives the politics. And full disclosure here, Brad and I squawked once or twice when I was at the State Department over some of what Russia, some of what Microsoft did in Russia in terms of handing over data. But the point in all this is like that's an entirely different company where there are a broader set of stakeholders, where they have to very carefully consider stakeholder value, where boards of directors would much more meaningfully engage than they would in a totalitarian company like Meta. But what's different today than was true decades ago is that these are independent and powerful geopolitical actors. Whereas, you know, during World War II, the CEOs of America's biggest companies basically just took instruction from Washington. Nobody's giving instructions to the CEOs of these biggest companies. They have to, at the end of the day, follow the letter of the law, particularly sanctions law. But the choices they make independently are of pretty substantial consequence in a conflict like this one. I can't think of another conflict in the last 100 years where the role of the private sector has been as important as this one.
So what would your... A lot of founders, VCs listen to this show, so I want you to speak to them specifically. If your critique, and I agree with the critique around the lack of, this isn't about Zuckerberg dropping out of college, it's about the fact that there's like this broader experience that even normie tech worker Mark Zuckerberg could have experienced in his 20s if he had dropped out, become a product manager, but then become a CEO in his 30s. So talk to the people who are still experiencing the world or are trying to basically haven't reached the heights of Zuckerberg. How should they think about their roles? How should they like learn these? It just seems like there's the part of the audience question that's so helpful is that in most of these cases, I don't trust any of these people, separate from political trust. This is even about graduate degrees. I don't trust these people to make the calculus around Russia and what is too far, when is the off-ramp. So what would your advice be to them specifically?
My advice is first of all, educate yourself. And don't educate yourself on Twitter. Like don't educate yourself by watching a handful of YouTube videos. I mean, if the decisions that you make actually matter on this, then, you know, in a certain respect, you need to go back to school. You need to do a little bit of good old fashioned reading and learning on this. And the second thing is like, if you're on a board of directors or if you're on a management team and you're looking around the table and you don't have anybody who has actually been in Kyiv, who hasn't actually navigated the complex geopolitics of that part of the world, then you're missing something. And so it is, you know, there's a chapter in my book called Does Every Company Need a State Department, Pentagon, or CIA? And that was a deliberately provocative question. And the answer is not necessarily yes. I'm not saying every company needs its own State Department to do international negotiation, Defense Department to engage in cyber defense, or CIA to do intelligence and analytics. But what I am saying is it's important that if you are an international company, that you surround yourself with people who understand what's taking place in that part of the world and who can, and with whom you can have a dialogue about how that then lines up with your strategy. It's a form of maturation. I mean, the idea that you can just build something cool in San Jose and unleash it in the world, and it then takes over the world without any sort of geopolitical disruption, that was true 10 years ago. It's not true today. Interestingly, for me, this is the first time I feel like, quote unquote, Silicon Valley saw this was after 9/11, where we began to see the impact of tech playing a role in radicalization. You know, so much of the radicalization that took place in the Middle East over a period of decades took place online. And that was the first time where I feel like Silicon Valley had to smarten up on something that they didn't have any native understanding of. And I think this is a new example of, you know, a demonstration that you need to raise your IQ here in the same way in which you would need to raise your IQ in a new programming language or, mm-hmm. you know, a new advertising platform or anything else.
So two last big questions. So the first one would be, when people say in their questions, I don't feel comfortable with this, I don't like this dynamic, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with these companies making these sorts of big decisions, it's implied as if their discomfort matters, in the sense that we are uncomfortable when bad things happen under the political jurisdiction of the United States, because the suggestion is our Democratic representatives either aren't doing something or they're corrupt or there's a new law we need to pass. Is there anything, given the nature of these companies, they're not American, either values or legally often, yet they're still tied to Western foreign policy. Like, you know, Putin, in this case, certainly considers the company all of these companies American. Is there any actual, should there be? And if not, is there or could there be any democratic input? I don't see there as being one, because like, once again, like what would the law, so this is what I raise to people. Like, I get where they're coming, but it's like, there's no law that we could pass that would say, Apple, you have to service the Russian metro. It doesn't work that way. So I'm curious how you think about this like dynamic.
So first of all, 80% of these questions have already been answered as a matter of law. So one of the things, you know, you can be really critical of the Biden administration on 100 different topics. But one of the things that they did well was in the lead up to Putin's invasion of Ukraine, the degree to which the United States and the EU stitched up on everything is fairly remarkable. Mm-hmm. So the fact that there is basically a single statutory and regulatory approach between the EU and the United States right now governing the behavior of the private sector of business in Russia means that 80% of this is taken off the table. So most of what Apple or Microsoft or Exxon or anybody else wants to do in Russia, even if they wanted to do it through democratic consent or not, they can't do it because the EU and the United States just told them they can't. And even if they're incorporated on the Isle of Man, you know what? Nobody's going to run afoul of both the EU market and the American market. That then leaves, let's call it 20%. If 80% of this has been decided by new sanctions, restrictions, what's left in the other 20%?
Quickly, could you give some examples of what those 80%, because most people I'm seeing on Twitter be like, oh, it's all like virtue signal-y stuff. Like what is that 80%? Like, what are examples of things that have to be done given these laws?
Yeah, cutting off access to the financial system. So, you know, the idea that we now can't lend money to Russian, that an American institution can't lend money to a Russian institution, or that a Russian institution that has a line of credit with an American bank can't access it. It doesn't matter what Citibank or JP Morgan or anybody else thinks or wants. The United States and the EU just made that illegal. So, you know, the biggest example here really goes to capital markets. It's not as sexy as something like Google cutting off Google AdWords, but it's much more economically consequential. So the biggest thing that the Europeans and the Americans did is cut off access to the global capital markets, with the exception of China. And so if I were to think of one more example of that, I would think of, you know, some of the retail pullout. So a lot of the retail pullout that is taking place right now, some people could say, oh, it's virtue signaling. You know, how much fried chicken are they selling in Moscow anyway? Well, simple fact of the matter is that if you can't transfer the money that goes into the cash register in Moscow to your bank account outside of Russia, then, you know, you're effectively running a cash negative business. So that decision, again, even with a retail presence in Russia, even if it is legal for you to keep that business open, if you're a company based in Europe, in the United States, and you literally can't wire that money back home to your home accounts, then, you know, this is not working for you. So there are two examples of the 80%.
So let's get to the 20, I'm sure, of which includes EA Sports taking Russia's national team off of FIFA, which is frankly something I also support. But yeah, let's get into the 20%.
So that's exactly it. So the 20%, if you think about the big global institutions like FIFA, you know, there are 196 sovereign nation states, and it doesn't matter what the politics of any one of those 196 countries are, you're supposed to be able to play soccer, right? The Paralympics, the Russians were literally just banned from the Paralympics. So all of this, everything that's multilateral and global in nature, to which the Russians have just been cut off, have been cut off irrespective of sanctions, because they're international institutions that are not subject to the law of the EU or the United States. So there's an example. There's an example of the 20%. Another example of the 20% are countries that don't actually have some of these sanctions in place that are pulling out. So non-EU, non-US companies that are pulling out, that are not a part of the European Monetary Union or others. So like IKEA, I think based on how they were incorporated, if they wanted to keep on operating in Russia, they could. They'd been there for 22 years, they pulled out. When they did so, they did so voluntarily.
So you raised one more question here, aside from my last one, which is another question we got was around international institutions and whether or not they function. There's obviously the critique of there's been the ever present long-term critique of the UN, you know, bad faith, why is Saudi Arabia on the human rights, you know, commission, Russia, China veto, US vetoes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems like the UN structure and a lot of multilateral institutions are not set up, or it's not that they're not set up, but they are sort of superfluous to the discussion we're having here. So given that dynamic, you don't have to have a policy proposal, but just how do you think about that dynamic here?
So speaking about the United Nations specifically, I think the fact that Russia is chairing the United Nations Security Council right now sort of lampoons the very nature of the UN Security Council. The United Nations has basically become, I won't say worthless, but all it is a point of convening. It's really not a point of problem solving right now. And the only time that they do problem solve is when the place is so weak and so isolated that they don't have the standing to do anything in the United Nations. But even if you were to go back to like the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, you know, you wouldn't have thought of Rwanda as a country that could have, you know, flexed, so to speak, in the United Nations to, you know, either get the UN in or keep them out. But nevertheless, the UN was late. And so the United Nations, I think, decreasingly looks like a credible geopolitical actor. So what that then leaves are other institutions, whether it's the G7, whether it's NATO. I mean, it's interesting, you know, the EU has oftentimes been condemned as a bunch of feckless, you know, Brussels bureaucrats, but the EU and NATO, both of which have looked beleaguered over the last 10 to 15 years, now look incredibly relevant and incredibly strong. So the point of collaboration is really going to be in formats like those. Getting bigger than that and getting, you know, going beyond sort of the West, you think about like the G20 and the G77 or multilateral institutions like this, you end up in many respects deadlocked, just like you would in the UN, because if the Chinese join the Russians, then there's nowhere else to go. And so those larger institutions, as a practical matter, they're great places to go and have meetings, but they aren't going to actually do anything. And I think we saw this further with COVID. You know, COVID, it is, in my opinion, was a spectacular example of a failure of multilateralism. You know, COVID is something that should have been attached globally. It should have been attacked globally, and with a lot of collaboration across states, you know, like we did with Ebola, for example. But somehow we managed to spectacularly screw that up. And somehow we managed to devolve our responses to COVID to 196 sovereign nation states, as opposed, you know, the World Health Organization proved to be feckless and completely captured by the Chinese. The CDC, you know, was not the global leader that it was during Ebola. So unfortunately, in all of this, what we're seeing is a really terrible period of multilateralism. We are not seeing much in the way of cooperation and collaboration between countries, unless it's within sort of your very close community of friends, as we see, for example, with NATO.
Takeaway seems to be multilateralism is much more regional and ideological rather than just broad-based. So you just mentioned China, so I'll ask the China question. How are authoritarian states, powerful authoritarian states, right? There's this broad narrative right now. There's this competition between liberalism and illiberalism, authoritarianism versus decentralized democracy. What are their lessons from what just happened? Because a lot of the pushback to what's happening here too is this claim of hypocrisy. This is where the virtue signaling thing comes in, which is these companies claim they're making a moral stand, but they would never do this if China invaded Taiwan. But that being said, to your point, everything that you just outlined, from how quickly the US and the EU came together to how, frankly, like it's insane that Finland and Sweden are now pro-NATO in a way, whether that happens or not, it seems like there's actually a lot more ambiguity. And that has to be a factor, even if you're Xi Jinping. How do you think about that?
First of all, Xi Jinping is one of the savviest leaders on planet Earth. And I'm sure he went into this with both eyes open to see what the response would be to Russia's incursion, to Russians' invasion of Ukraine, you know, thinking very carefully about Taiwan. And I honestly believe that the strength of the response from the West to what took place in Ukraine probably impacted his plans for Taiwan. I bet he will think about Taiwan very differently than he did previously. To your question though, about the virtue signaling where you say, oh, well, companies will do this with Russia because it's, you know, at the end of the day, it has the GDP as the size of Spain. You know, it's not in the top 10 in terms of global GDP, but they wouldn't do it in China. That may be the case, but let's go back to an earlier point in our conversation where, you know, as a legal matter, the United States and the EU basically took 80% of this off the table. So at the end of the day, if the Chinese did do something in Taiwan and the EU and the United States slapped a series of sanctions on China, it doesn't matter how attractive a market China is for selling iPhones. If we say the sale of electronics into China is illegal, and oh, by the way, regardless of whatever banana republic, you know, the subsidiary of the iPhone maker is incorporated in, if, you know, it's easy enough to write regulations to work around that, then they're not going to sell iPhones in China. I do think, though, that an important outcome of all of this is that it has demonstrated to China that there is an incredibly high cost to this level of aggression. And I think China will actually be more sensitive to the economic dimension of this than Putin would be. You know, I think Putin is in a position to withstand a lot of the economic pressures here. Certainly, he's in a better position to withstand them than his citizens. In China, I believe that Xi would be very, very, very sensitive to the costs, to the economic costs of entering into any kind of a sanctions regime. The difference here, though, is, of course, it would exert a bigger cost to us as well, because our economy is much more entangled with the Chinese than it is with the Russians.
What I love about doing this daily series is that I've actually just learned something new every single time. What I just learned, this goes to your point, is those corporate statements with the flowery language and the pullouts, they actually worked in the sense that they've convinced all of us, myself included, that this was all voluntary. I had that 80%. I just want to pull stuff out because I don't know how on Twitter you are, but there is a whole Twitter discourse around these companies are doing all these things and they're choosing to. I don't think people know this. That's fascinating. So here's the actual final question. Despite using the words virtue signal to describe this, I hate when people take American culture war discourse and apply to this dynamic. So this is virtue signal, this is deplatform, this is cancel. Regardless of how you feel about these issues, in the US domestic political context, they are not helpful in describing the phenomenon as we're talking about it today, because they're just too loaded. What would your, and this is the version I want to talk to you, like how should we verbalize? So when Apple turns off the subway things, I think people really viscerally felt that. I mean, it's because I'm in New York. People were like, oh shit, like if I couldn't use, wow, like that's crazy. What is that? If it isn't deplatforming, if it's not canceling, if it's not virtue signaling.
So, you know, you are better at this language than I am, first of all. But the point that I would make just in arguing this, in talking about this, is Exxon, who, let me tell you, you know, good old Texas-based Exxon is not a part of cancel culture. Like Exxon is the kind of company being canceled. When they break the relationship with Rosneft, like, you could call that deplatforming Rosneft, but it puts it, so much of when we discuss this, we are using the sort of intellectual and emotional triggers that come with sort of California tech, you know, Apple, Facebook, you know, the hipster lefty tech guys. But at the end of the day, the deplatforming is taking place in big banks. It's taking place with oil companies. So I don't know if I don't know that I can come up with the language. It's at the end of the day, it's sanctions. And
that's the point. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, this is a sanctions regime that is top down and it is dominantly state based. Because I got news for you. BP is going to feel the pain from its deplatforming with Russian oil and gas. Exxon invested over $10 billion into, you know, its Siberian programs. It's saying it's pulling out. They're not doing this out of wokeness. They're not doing this because they're a bunch of kumbaya lefties. They're doing this because either A, they have to and are compelled to do so by law, and or B, they feel like they can't be a part of playing ball with a regime like the Putin regime. And if they can contribute to an acceleration of positive change in a country like Russia, then ultimately it can become a market where they can really do some work.
Yeah, that's an excellent place to leave. Alec, thank you so much for joining. Would you mind just shouting out the book again for the audience and all that great stuff?
Of course. So my book is called The Raging 2020s. Countries, companies, people, and the fight for our future.
Well said, Alec. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.